You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. Sometimes in the history of nations, something small unintentionally sets off something big because the something small starts to uncover smoldering, long-standing issues. In Tunisia, a fruit seller who had his cart confiscated for lack of a permit set fire to himself, and those flames ignited the Tunisian Revolution and eventually the Arab Spring. An electrician climbed over a shipyard fence to join strikers in Poland and set off a chain reaction that eventually ended communism there. In Chile, protests over higher metro fares, started just over a year ago, grew and picked up causes and picked up grievances, grew some more, and shook one of Latin America's most stable states. The rising resistance led to the passage of a referendum to rewrite the national constitution. Chile's current charter was written by a brutal dictator. In the 1970s, General Augusto Pinochet violently overthrew Chile's democratically elected president with support from the CIA. His regime imprisoned, tortured, or killed nearly 40,000 people. It also drafted a constitution that enshrined free market economic policies. And experts say that fueled inequality. When an overwhelming majority of Chileans voted to rewrite their constitution on October 25th, tens of thousands of people celebrated in the streets. Daniel Alarcón was in Santiago reporting on the protests for The New Yorker magazine, and he joins me now. And Daniel, is that landslide reform vote the end of something or just the beginning?
Yeah, Ray, I think that's a good way of framing it. The protests that began over the 30 pesos price hike, one of their slogans was, "It's not 30 pesos, it's 30 years," referring to the 30 years of the constitution that Pinochet had written and had installed as kind of the law of the land in the country. And I think that for many, and politicians said this to me, and young people said this to me, and students and protesters said this to me again and again in the streets of Santiago, that for them, this was really about turning the page. You know, it was about the last sort of legal vestiges of the dictatorship being excised from that legacy. And I think that's really important to understand what happened in Chile. It's that there was this almost emotional need for a definitive break from the past. And that's, to me, that's what this vote represents.
It sounds from your reporting and what people on the street were telling you that there were grievances, frustrations, resentments that had been building up over the last generation that finally got an airing. What were they?
Well, I think the principal one is this notion of inequality. Chile has one of the highest inequality rates in the region. The top 5%, you know, owns the vast majority of the wealth in the country. The president himself is a businessman. He's extraordinarily wealthy, from one of the richest families in the country. Is worth $5 billion. He is a, you know, very much a free market capitalist. It's just part of who he is, and it's part of what the right wing is. Meanwhile, the average Chilean worker is spending a quarter of his income to finance debt. You know, there's this sense, and I say this as a Peruvian who's visited Chile many, many times, there was a sense that everything was fine. There was a sense that I had, certainly, that Chile had somehow figured out how to be a middle-class, stable democracy in a region where that's a fairly rare thing. And it was a surprise to me in my reporting to find that, I think it was a surprise for a lot of regional observers to see Chile sort of unmasked. And that's what these protests did. They revealed deep wells of discontent, anger, rage at a system that that many felt was rigged in favor of the elites, in favor of people with money. And these very small 30 pesos price increase, which is nothing, you know, it's 4 cents. And students themselves were exempt. But I think it was more the idea of the indignity of it. I heard people say this again and again, that it was, you know, it was young people telling me it was our parents who were going to have to pay that. And the fact that the transportation minister said, well, you know, if people want to avoid the price hike, they should just get up a little earlier, when Chileans are already working.
Wow. Oh,
exactly. Man. It's that the cluelessness of that kind of statement is just offensive. You know, when people are already commuting across a massive city, waking up at ungodly hours, getting home, you know, after their kids have gone to sleep. And then this minister is saying, oh, just wake up a little earlier and you can avoid the 30 pesos, is just offensive. You know, there are sort of big structural changes, and there's big demands, and there are policy demands. But at the end of the day, what brings people out in the streets is a sense of, we've had enough. You know, you can't offend our dignity any longer. And it's no surprise to me that the main sort of the epicenter of these protests became known as Plaza Dignidad, Dignity Plaza. And that's really, to me, what this was about.
It sounds like the confrontations between people and security forces got pretty bad eventually. I mean, 30 people died before it was over. Did the government think that it had the license to use that kind of force?
Well, let's remember that immediately after what became known as El Estallido in October of last year, President Piñera made a statement saying we're at war, essentially. We're facing an implacable enemy who will stop at nothing. It was never clear who the implacable enemy was. And for many Chileans, this kind of bellicose, militaristic talk was very frightening because of the legacy of Pinochet. And they took it to mean the enemy is us, because we're the ones who are marching in the streets, you know, ordinary Chileans. The response from police, and I should mention the Carabineros in Chile were until fairly recently a you know, pretty well-respected institution as far as institutions go in Chile. But the response was violent, was unhinged at times, tear gas, excessive use of force. There was a spate of ocular injuries where, you know, protesters were hit with rubber bullets in the eyes and blinded. More than 400 people were suffered eye injuries. I mean, there were really, really terrible abuses. And in a country that has this deep memory of the trauma of the dictatorship, to see these kinds of abuses from the authorities really sort of shifted things, I think. And you could see it on the streets, in the graffiti, in conversations. And there was one moment that I remember that sort of encapsulated this for me. I was in a restaurant, sort of in an outdoor cafe, and a police truck drove by. Everybody in the restaurant stopped, put down their forks, put down their glasses, and shouted at the police vulgarities that I won't repeat here. And then the police, you know, the truck passed through the intersection, and then everyone went back to normal. But the anger at the police was something just extraordinary. I'd never seen anything quite like it.
It sounds like there was a serious disconnect between the people at the top of the social hierarchy and the rank and file Chilean voter. This is a country that, after all, elected Michelle Bachelet to be president, a social democrat, and yet, twice, you couldn't change laws that were written to solely benefit business and capital. If there were social democratic impulses among the voters, the Constitution was a pretty rigid document, as I understand. You couldn't express that in the sort of operating manual for the society.
Yeah, and there are numerous examples. This was by design, I should say, and I think it's important to mention that. You know, the Constitution that Pinochet had ratified, he comes into power with a CIA-backed coup in 73, immediately creates a constitutional committee led by Jaime Guzman, who was this kind of right-wing intellectual law professor. And that Constitution that began in 1980... was really designed to create a framework for a transition to democracy at some point that was not completely defined, but to create a democracy that had guardrails. And they use that phrase, you know, democracy with protections. And the protections from what? From socialism, from what they saw as the excesses of the Allende regime that they had overthrown. So the state's power was limited legally under the Constitution, the outgoing Constitution, unable to get involved in sort of in market decisions, basically, sort of like ceding a lot of ground to the market. And this was completely by design. And there were numerous examples of consumer protections, of rights of water that would get you know, passed and get supported, and then, you know, there would be a suit and it would go to the constitutional tribunal, and then the law would be struck down. And I think what's surprising as an outside observer, Ray, I have to say, is that somehow all of this rage and anger coalesced around a constitutional issue. And it's not often that you would see a protest movement get so focused on a policy change that is both that massive and that arcane. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think that as an outsider was really interesting to see. Fairly high level legal constitutional discussions happening in the streets and on corners. And I remember being on the subway in Santiago and hearing the, you know, this busker come through the subway rapping, you know, like a 5-minute rap about the pension system, and then asking for change, you know. But like, that's just the kind of thing you don't see. I mean, I read, you know, before quarantine, I used to ride the train in New York all the time. I never saw anyone rapping about the pension system or the Constitution.
Earlier in our conversation, you talked about how these protests unmasked some of the anger in Chilean society. Did the process, did the aftermath also unmask the deep roots that Chile's profile in the rest of the world has among the people themselves as a democratic, literate, prosperous, stable place? Could this entire episode end up with a Chile with that reputation intact in the rest of the world?
Well, I think that answer depends sort of on your ideological perspective from the start. I mean, from my point of view, I see this as a sign of tremendous political maturity. It's an impressive feat that began with a very small high school protest and grew into this constitutional question, which, you know, there is no bigger question for a country politically. There was, you know, violence, and there were protests, and there was instability, and there will be some of that going forward for sure. But the election day itself in Chile was peaceful, was well run, was well ordered, you know, maintained public health guidelines, and was, from most accounts, you know, a great success. And there was a resounding mandate for turning the page, finally, from the legal framework that was created by the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. So I've emerged from this reporting with a greater respect for the Chilean people and for its political maturity. And I'll be watching this with great interest and a lot of hope to see what comes next.
As we have this conversation, we're less than a week away from, well, pretty consequential elections in the United States. If anybody's morale is flagging, elections still matter, right? And if you needed any proof, just head to Santiago.
Yeah. Elections matter tremendously. I mean, I've been talking with my children, my sons, about what happened in Chile and how you never know what is going to spark, you know, a massive change. I think the protests began and they grew and they coalesced around a big question that was easy to articulate to a lot of people. And it became a referendum on the future. And, you know, we know what happened in Chile. I think it's important to sort of remember that politics do matter. And I think that it's important also to note that politics perhaps are more effective when people are able to understand how big questions affect their daily lives.
Daniel Alarcón is a journalist. You can read his reporting from Santiago, Chile in The New Yorker. You can hear him on Radio Ambulante and elsewhere. Daniel, a pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Great to speak with you, Ray. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from First Republic Bank, Chevron, Dentons, Asset Management Company, and Jonathan and Marit Visbal. This episode was produced by Joanne Jennings, Teresa Katsourilis, Jared Sport, and Andrew Steltzer. Temba Daniels provided research assistance. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.